Well, good morning, everyone. Really good to see all you brave, courageous people. Must be some of the bravest people in the world. So I'm going to give you all a hand for everything you're trying to do with these children that God has given into your care. So, yeah, my name's Conrad Eby, and my wife, Marilyn, she's going to share some too, hopefully more than me. And a little bit about ourselves. I do counseling for a living. I work at a clinic and do clinical type of work. And I started out working with people off the street of Cumberland, and then it kind of shifted to Anabaptist people now. So my clientele is, Aryan people. So I want to talk a little bit about early trauma, and specifically early trauma before a child can talk and reason. So if you think about how you think, you actually think in language. Like, at least I do. Like, I think thoughts, it's words, it's things that I communicate. So before a child knows how to speak and walk and talk, a lot of our kids have experienced trauma in those years, maybe even before they were born. Our child actually had a twin that was miscarried like at 6 months and absorbed. So in a sense, our daughter went through death in utero. It was already exposed to death before she was born. So that all has a huge impact on how the child develops. So I'm going to talk about something this morning. There's a great big word for it, and it sounds confusing, but hopefully it'll explain almost everything. What I don't get, she'll get. It's called an unrepresented emotional state. And what that means is that a child can have an emotion that they don't know why they have. So they just have this emotion, but they can't tell you why they feel that way. So a lot of our children come to us with a huge sense of abandonment and a huge sense of betrayal and a huge sense of helplessness and loss. But none of your children remember the separation of them and their birth parents if it happened before they were like 2 years old. So your body, we have multiple forms of memory. So one form of memory we have is a thought memory. Another form of memory we have is more of a body memory. So the things that happen to your children before they can remember is stored in their body. They know it is there, but they can't tell you what it is because it was pre-verbal. They don't know how to talk about it, and they don't remember it in their brain, but their body knows it. It's kind of like, it feels to them kind of like an instinct. It's something they intuitively know, but they can't explain it to you. So let's just start with this, the handout that has 19 points on it, and fill in the blank type of thing. Number one, if there is an adoption, that means that there was a traumatic separation. At the best, it was some sort of trauma. Depends on how it happens, it can be more severe than others. But there's a lot of bonding that takes place between the child and that birth mom by the time they're born, that no matter how the separation happens, that child knows something happened. All trauma has effects, but early trauma has some unique qualities, and that's what I want to talk about, the what happens before they can remember and have language is particularly, has its own particular challenges to work with. Babies do not have the brain, number three, brain, babies do not have the brain capabilities for language and thought. So a lot of what gets remembered before they can speak is more like an impression. I think she mentioned something about trauma being imprinted on the brain. What happens before they can remember is like it's imprinted on their biology, but they do not understand it and they can't explain it to you. This is really important to understand this theory of an unrepresented emotional state. And by the way, what I'm talking about here is the highest level of psychological understanding of a child. Like, I get my supervision from the International Institute of Psychotherapy. So the people I bounce things off of, it comes from the highest think tank in the world. Now, I'm not trying to brag. I'm just very, very fortunate to have made a contact with somebody who was willing to supervise me. So what you need to understand in number four, language and thought, and what I want you to write in that blank is it's the binding agent between a historical happening and the felt experience. So let's say I pull out down here in the road and I have a wreck, right? And I have emotions about that wreck. I suppose I was almost killed. I shouldn't have much, it's a very scary experience, but that scary experience will be associated with that experience of the wreck. Okay, so you have the wreck is the historical incident. The emotions that go with it will stay together because I can talk about it and I can explain to you what happened. So the language and thought bind a physical experience and the emotions together. Okay, so you can do that if you have language and thought. Like, your children can tell you how they felt about anything after they learned to speak and talk. Before that, they can't tell you, but they know it was there, right? Very, very unique situation. So, number five, since there's no language and thought, it is hard for the children to keep the emotions experienced in the separation from their birth parents connected with that event. So the trauma that happens when a child is separated from their birth parents is deeply imprinted on them, but they don't even know it. They don't even know why they have that. They're completely clueless why they have that feeling. So, number seven, since the baby had little reasoning ability, as the child grows up, their bodies remember the feeling, but they are clueless of where the feelings are coming from. So now, number eight, now we have a child that feels traumatized, but has no language or thoughts to tell you why or what they're feeling. So, you have an historic event. The child is taken from its biological parent. They have a huge emotional experience connected with that, but they have no binding agent to keep that experience and those emotions together. So, since there's no binding agent, the feelings become separated from that event, and they become like a free-floating phenomenon of their own. So it's like these feelings of betrayal, abandonment, helplessness becomes like a snowball that rides on their shoulder that's looking for a home, because they don't know where it come from and they don't know why they feel that way. So they're carrying it like on their shoulder. They're going through life, and let's say they're 5 years old or whatever, and they have a little disappointment. And on a scale of 1 to 10, it might be a 2 or 3, but they come out with like a 15, just raving mad or whatever they're doing. And you're like, what is up with that? Well, what happened is that ball is riding on their shoulder and it's looking for a home. And all of a sudden, so their brain, this might be it. This is why I feel the way I do. And they unload on that thing. But it doesn't work because it's not authentic. It's not the real problem. And so they eventually get over it, and then they bounce on to the next thing and the next thing. So number 10, the tendency is for the child to overreact to rather small signs of danger because their brain is looking for a reason to explain the way they feel. Is this making sense? Okay. Number 11, when a child cannot go out of their head and say what made them feel this way, they will always internalize negatively toward themselves. So they don't know why they have this feeling, but it must be because I'm bad, stupid, ugly, dumb, worthless. And they internalize it toward themselves. So our children tend to have really low sense of value, really low sense of appreciation, and all that trauma that they don't understand gets turned toward themselves. So you can think about this. This is another problem without not having language or thought. But if something happens to me, I can kind of go out of my head and wrap my mind around it, so to speak. But if I don't have language and thought, I can't go out of my head and explain it. So the next alternative is to go negatively inward toward myself, is what almost always happens. And they believe all the lies about themselves. I'm not lovable, I'm defective, I'm hate, I'm just evil, I'm wicked. It goes on and on how they will talk about themselves. But they're trying to figure out why they feel the way they feel. Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm stupid. Maybe I'm defective. So, number 12, trauma cements some issues and obliterates other issues. So, one thing that gets cemented in the child's mind is that the world is not a good place to be. You can't trust your parents. You're helpless. And this one is particular to early child trauma, because if you think about it, a baby is helpless. So whatever state a child is in their development when the trauma happens, whatever they're working on at that point in their life will get cemented negatively. So they're helpless as a baby. Trauma happens. They will forever want to feel helpless. So you get your child and you're trying to do homework with him. I can't do it. I just can't. And they just melt down. I just can't. And they actually can, but it's a that feeling that wells up within them is just, I can't. I'm just helpless. They feel so. We talk about triggers. So when you're in the present and you have a trigger, and let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, it's only a 3. It serves two purposes. Not only is it a little bit of stress in the present, but it also opens their memory, emotional memory, to similar situations, and that comes rushing forward, combines with the present, and they get an overwhelming response. So, I can't get my math problem, and they're stressed about it. The feeling that comes up inside of them is the same feeling they had when they were 1 month old and were completely powerless and helpless. That's the feeling that comes to them because that's where the trauma was cemented. Other things that get cemented are fear, abandonment. All the negative stuff will tend to get cemented. The opposite of what gets cemented is what gets obliterated. And what gets obliterated is trust, sense of power, which is the opposite of helplessness, and object permanence. Now, I want to explain object permanence. When a child, let's say, is like 1 year old, and they're playing on the floor, and mom's right there, they're fine. But mom goes, runs into the next room to get something. Oh, the child melts down. Mom, mom, where we at? And then mom comes back, and then they're fine. But as that child develops, they will learn to know that even though mom isn't present, doesn't mean she doesn't exist. So it's peekaboo. Mom's there, it's cloning it. They have to learn to get past the peekaboo problem. And it's really hard for our children to trust that when you disappear, that you're still there even though they can't see you. So that sense of trust gets broken. Like if they can't see you, they do not trust that you're going to come back. Like if you go away for an hour or two or three and let them somewhere, it's like, are you going to come back? Are you going to come back? Are you going to come back? And they're like, absolutely, we're going. Look you straight in the face and say, yeah, but you can die. You cannot convince them that they're safe because they've already experienced abandonment by the people who meant the most to them. So that is something that is very hard for them to get. And she talked about safety, which is really good. But sometimes I think we might need to talk about death and dying. And that, in a sense, none of us are safe. And if we're okay, like, if we die, it's not the worst thing that could happen. Like, even in death, we're safe in Jesus. But a lot of us adults aren't even comfortable with that, right? So number 15, most children, now I want to be very careful with this one because this can be really difficult for you mothers to be okay with, but most children do not want to be rescued. They would much rather, deep in their soul, they would rather that their birth parents would have been successful. So, what happens is you get a child that you want to bond with you, and you think you're making some progress, and all of a sudden you discover they're just sad. They're sitting in their bed and they're just crying tears that are just so sad. And you're like, what's up? But they're actually grieving the loss of their birth parents. And if you're in the middle of trying to love a child and you want them to love you so bad, and they're grieving somebody else that they actually wish they had, that can be really frustrating to a mom. This can be very distressing to the adoptive parents because you want the child to bond with you, but here you're discovering them grieving the loss of their birth parents. Number 18, we must be patient with a child during these times and understand their loss. So you have to be big enough to love them, and even when they are grieving somebody else. And I want to say one thing again very, very carefully. But if you want to be an adoptive parent because you want a child to fulfill the emptiness of your heart, don't adopt. Get your heart full before you adopt. There's a lot of people that go into adoption with a huge hole in their heart. Maybe it's because of infertility. Maybe it's something else. But we get this feeling that if we just had a child, then our life would be meaningful. Then we would have something to live for. And we adopt a child that has nothing to give us. They're 100% needy. So here I am with a broken heart, trying to love something that doesn't really love me. And we end up having the same needs if I adopt out of an empty heart. So I just want to throw that out there. Like, moms, please plug into resources, because you need a flow coming in, because you're going to need a flow going out, and you're going to have to get support to be able to do it well. So that's my part. Why can't you point on you?
Because you can explain it better.
So on the page it says attachment cycle on the pictures. Okay, yeah. So the way bonding happens with an infant is through the baby expressing needs and the caregiver meeting their needs. So the baby's hungry, baby cries, mom comes running, feeds the baby gets happy, and then in turn mom gets happy because now she's a good mom, right? Because she can make the baby happy. And then the baby, when the baby's happy, the child usually has some sort of appreciation for the parent. That gives the parent energy to feed back into the child. So it's a circle. And if it's done well, the child will develop feelings of I am worthy, the world is safe, others can be relied upon. But what about if the opposite happens? Suppose baby's hungry, they cry, nobody comes. They cry some more, nobody comes. Eventually, the baby starts shutting down, doesn't make its needs known, and the all kinds of difficult things start developing in that child because there's no reciprocal response to their expression of need. So they start to feel that others are unreliable. They have to find ways on their own to take care of themselves. And they start to believe that the world is not a nice place, and they become cynical, revengeful, and problematic.
Well, good moms work themselves out of a job, and that's mainly what I did with my handouts. I worked myself out of a job, so I didn't need to talk very much. So you can look over your papers, too. Some of the things I put on, just because when we were starting out, I had no idea where to start reading and where to start researching. And so just like the retained primitive reflexes, that's something I don't know a lot about, but I am learning if you can work on those. If children have retained primitive reflexes, you can really help them work through some of that. So some things I put on just for maybe somewhere to start researching, if your children are having unexplained issues. Grief isn't just for death. I like that one. Children can grieve for a lot of things. And also, as you try to help them heal, releasing who you once were, that can be hard to work through too, or just to accept.
What do you mean by that?
Accept the new you. Letting go of the old you.
The one that knew everything, or what?
No. FASD, that one is a lot of symptoms that show up in a lot of other diagnoses. Also, when I started reading about that, one of them that stood out to me the most was struggle to understand cause and effect. Just didn't understand the consequences they were getting. Nothing was ever their fault.
So that one's really important because in social science, 2 + 2 = 4, right? So if I punch her, she's going to want to kick me in the shins, right? That's just common sense and behavior. And if your child has fetal alcohol syndrome, even slightly, one of the first things that get affected is their ability to make connections between cause and effect and behavior. So, and it, this also makes helping them really hard because it's like to help them connect their behavior with their past trauma, they can't go backward either. So it's just like they act out of instinct. They just do what they do without a lot of thought. I don't know if you've ever experienced that or not, but it's just like their behavior is bang, 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 bang. And it's like you can say, why'd you do that? I don't know. And you try to reason with them, and it's just like you can't make those connections. Like it's difficult to understand because you're just like, why don't you get it? why don't you get it? And they just can't. They can't get it. Because that association ability between, so punishment don't work. Like, they have a behavior and you say, now, because you did that, you need to do this. And they will take it as you getting even, not that it's something to learn from. So it becomes really hard to change their behavior through the normal methods of discipline, because but if they do a behavior and you give them a spanking, they don't put that together. That doesn't make no sense to them at all. All they know is they got smacked on the butt. And it's like, whatever that was about, bebop off to the next thing. Some of you are laughing, you always know what I'm talking about. And it's just like mind-blowing. And you can take that child to therapy, and you might get some emotion worked out of them, but it's pretty ineffectual as far as behavior modification. And they become, they're actors, they're copycats, they're mimics, and they feel inauthentic because they really don't have it connected to their soul. They're just doing what they want to do. And so it's, you almost have to, the best thing you can do for these type of children is keep them safe. Try to protect them from destroying themselves, because they can't learn cause and effect. And some of them will get it, but they're like 5 to 10 years delayed. So you'll have a 18-year-old that'll be 12 going on 25. Like, they're part of their personality will be real babies, and yet they'll be trying to do things that's way above their age level. And I call that a stretched personality. And you have to just pray that God somehow protects them. Like, our daughter right now is not in her home because we couldn't keep her safe anymore. She wanted to just do this and do that and do that. I finally went to the judge and said, look, I know I'm responsible, and I just want to let you know I can't keep her safe no more. And so they had to do something else with her, because I was like, what can you do to keep her safe another 2 years? Maybe her brain will start making connections. But, you know, 2 years, she's going to be 18. And God only knows what's going to happen if her brain doesn't start working. Because she acts just out of impulse and instinct. And a lot of her instinct is survival. So it's stuff that don't work well in the adult world.
I got you talking.
How'd you do that? Do you love me, Mom? Do you love me? Come on, do you love me?
He said he was going to try to get me going.
That's one thing our daughter would do. Like, she would do the
nasty. She'd do this, yeah, mean, nasty.
Nastiest thing you could think of. And you're trying to just so boiling mad. And she'd be like, do you love me, Mommy? Do you love me? Love me?
The other one on that paper, if someone with FASD is aggressive, it's usually because they are in over their heads. When you match your expectations with their ability, you see less aggression. And that's one thing I did really have to do, was lower my expectations down to what she was capable of. Which was much, 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 much younger some days. The next paper, 5 things to teach your kids no matter what. With her, I needed to explain things very simply and put things into just a couple words, and I'm a mom that can lecture and lecture endlessly, and so it was really hard for me to get down to really simple. And so I put that on just for ideas if you need very simple ways to explain things to your children.
We would get so frustrated because she would preach. Da 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 da, and us, the rest of us was like, "Mom, just stop. She's not getting it." But you get this desperation that you have to get through to this child, so you do it again and again and again and again. And you know what? She's in a state aid home right now, and she just sent us a letter and said, "There's 12 kids in that home. 7 of them are LGBTQ, and the rest of them identify as straight." And you know what? My wife's preaching is ringing in her head. She's like, "This is crazy. I ain't going to do this stuff." You know, so God bless her for all her preaching.
The power of the pause I put on for a special reason. So I, didn't have any books when she came. We weren't especially signed up as foster parents. We just have worked with 3 generations of her family. And so I started in with Karen Purvis, and she says, catch the behavior within 3 seconds, do a redo, redirect. And so, me being a good mom, I jumped on every single thing within the 3 seconds. They need to know that this isn't how you do. Doesn't work.
So it gives them an awful lot of chances to be reactive.
Yeah. So then I learned, stop, pause, and choose how you want to respond. And that's where you can not let them trigger you so bad, because they are professionals at figuring out your triggers.
How many here have heard of RAD? So you all pretty much know what it was. I just saw it a little bit ago. That little boy, one little boy jumped up and his dad said, "Hey, have a good time." Bang! Hit him just that quick. So it's like, they have to have that love and distance, and they just keep bouncing and bouncing.
Turn the paper over. Some of these are just for ideas again. The sensory seeker and the sensory avoider. That's just to give you some ideas and why they might be doing some of the things they do. They're actually trying to regulate themselves in doing all of that. Sensory seeker. We had a child that I said either she's going to have to kill herself or else she will be very agile and jump out of every fall and everything.
She liked joint stimulation, like jumping, anything that have impact on their joints, sometimes they like, and it somehow gives them some release of pent-up trauma. So rough, bouncing, jumping, all that kind of stuff, joint impact, they can be helpful.
I'm going to tell one funny story. We have swings hanging from big telephone pole frame, so it's really tall. When we first made it, she was climbing up the rope fairly far, and I said, "You're not allowed to climb to the top, ever." Okay, I shouldn't have given her the challenge. One day before too much longer, I came home after being gone just a very short time, and she started fussing about her hands hurting. And I wasn't connecting it at all. Eventually I looked at them and I said, "Well, it looks like burns on them." So I got her a bowl of cold water and she kept them in there like hours. Eventually I caught on. She had climbed the rope clear to the top, saw me coming home, and so she slid down the rope real fast and gave herself rope burn.
But sensory things can, if your child's messy, like they just want to get in the food and squish things and touch things and then touch everything and all that kind of stuff, they just love that. They just love sensory input.
I don't know anything about the sensory avoider. But I know they are out
there. Well, that's the one that I don't like certain food because, yeah, it feels weird. Or, you know, they have to have their certain place that they sit on and all kinds of things because they don't like how it feels.
The shirt tags, I might have had a child with the shirt tags, but... next paper, we didn't know any of this educational stuff when she came, and so we were like dealing with so much, and it's like, what helps? What can we do to help her? So a lot of things, what I finally figured out was brain exercises, especially anything crossing the midline of the brain, the invisible line. Lots of exercise. And the exercises here, I actually had another paper that I couldn't find that described some animal exercises, animal styled names with them. But this is somewhere to start. The hopping back and forth like a frog, the hands and feet on the floor with the hips up, walking like a bear. There's different things. Jumping jacks. Jumping jacks are really, really good for their brain if you can get them to do them. A lot of things you do for a little bit and they figure out how to help you forget that you were going to implement this new thing to try to help them.
So this is really important because if you remember the brain diagram, what's your name?
Ruth Ann.
Ruth Ann had up. There's like five major compartments of the brain and they all need to communicate with each other. So you have the danger sensing part of the brain and then you have the prefrontal cortex which does the thinking. The thinking part of your brain can calm the danger part of your brain down. But if that two parts don't communicate very well, you can think and think and think why I'm safe, but it still doesn't calm down. These exercises that cross over the midline of your brain, listen very carefully now, it reduces the ability of the brain to not communicate. Okay, it's almost like there's calluses or something in the brain, right? And you do these crossover, like this is a needle. Stick your thumb out like this. Hold your head still and then move your eyes and make a figure eight and follow figure eight sideways and follow your thumb without moving your head. Okay? You're forcing your brain to cross over between the left and right hemisphere. And these exercises dilute the ability of the brain to not communicate with each other. But
backside, as Simon says, examples. I think one of the things I wish I would have done more of was just simple obedience things. And Simon says is just fun, obeying fun things instead of getting stuck saying no all the time, to have fun things to do. And I would lose all my creativity and I couldn't come up with anything to do more than about three things and there we go, Simon says. But that's just a whole lot of ideas, not to do them all at once, but ideas to pull from when you're trying to have fun with your children, because playing with your children is extremely important. Neither one of us is real good at letting go and playing real much, and that could have probably been helpful through the years. The other thing for healing brains, rewiring, I learned how important music is. Music is extremely important for rewiring your brain. Can listen to music, but also if you sing or play an instrument, playing an instrument, they say, works all the parts of your brain together. And our child was very musical. She loved to sing. She could pick out beautiful tunes on the piano. But when I put her in lessons, then that took the fun out of it, and she didn't understand the theories of piano lessons. So maybe just enjoy letting them enjoy it. If they want lessons, she picked up guitar then and wanted lessons, so we did that for a little. But music is very, very healing to the brain. And I played a lot of music. I'm not really a singer myself, but I played a lot of music in the house, all different genres. Classical music especially is good. There's a set of, it's called Classical Kids. They take the famous composers and they make a story of their life and they play their music while they tell their story. I can pick out music from Bach and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and Mozart and all of them just from listening to the CDs when we first
started. The interesting thing about a lot of these composers, the famous composers, they were all half crazy. Like Bach and Beethoven, and so the music you're listening to is music that's born out of tormented minds and the beauty of it. So, like, our kids have trauma, but they almost all have something so beautiful about them that if you can tap into that and just build on that for all your worth, that sometimes they try you so bad you almost forget about their good stuff, but... Like, I know this isn't healthy, but our daughter was a charmer. Like, her social skills, her grandpa was a Kirby sweeper salesman, and he could sell anybody a sweeper. If you left him inside your house, you were done. And they would have...
He sold him one when I didn't want a Kirby sweeper.
They would have contests to see who could sell the most sweepers in the country, company. And he would always win so much that they eventually wouldn't let him participate. And his granddaughter has his, it's a mind-blowing game they play.
Manipulation.
They will manipulate you without you realizing you're being manipulated until it's a year down the road. You look at that and it's like, that was all a game. And you feel so burnt, so burnt.
I think art would be really, really good too. I tried to keep art supplies on hand for the children. She would go by spells of digging the stuff out. She actually got into macrame last summer, and that was actually really, really good because macrame, you're crossing the midline of the brain all the time doing your knots. So I didn't tell her for a while that she was actually helping herself out. I was just letting her have fun. This next paper is kind of for the burned out parents. Benefits of playing with your children. It is so good to play with them. When we went to RAD camp, they really stressed the importance of playing with your children. Playing with your children.
Quit making it. Why are you doing this?
You're just trying to get me down and I'm not going to.
You love me? You love me?
Pick it up now.
So where's my six R's? Repetitive relational. If you can for 7 minutes a day do relational, I didn't put this on the papers and I wished I had. Relational, relevant, repetitive, rewarding, rhythmic, respectful activities together for 7 minutes a day. No, 7 minutes. Five times a day. Well, once a day would be really, really important for us. we tended to get stuck in survival mode really bad. Really bad. Really bad. This was a burned out mom. A really burned out mom.
You know, our daughter left at about around the end of the year. And we had no clue how much she affected our family. Our bio children, make sure they're doing all right too, because she grew, and hope is in her quarters, she really messed up my years. Somehow her manipulation just really hit them wrong. And when my one son was like six, she's a half year younger, she could bully him, shove him around, insult him, and he was so mad one day. He was just seething mad. I was like, I gotta do something. So I went and got him a stick. He's just a peach of a kid. It wouldn't just hurt anybody. I got him a stick and I said, you carry that in your pocket. And I said, when she comes at you, I said, you're not allowed to hurt her, but you can use that stick. Oh boy, he got fucked up. And you know, she respected that stick. I don't think he ever had to use it. But it gave him power. You know, you got it. If you got a bully, you need to give the other kids some power. Keep after the healthy kids too.
The quiet ones. Because our other son needed some type of stick, and we didn't realize it till years and years down the road. And I don't know what would have worked for him, but he just shut down and went to reading all the time, and he was the fawn. He feels very bad taking any time away from the parents, and we didn't know it at the time.
Your kids are really good-hearted, and they will try to make life easier for you. Because they see you struggling with this one child, and the other kids will compensate by saying, hey, we got two kids. We can't cause any more trouble. Things are going to fly apart. So questions don't get asked. Lots of things that you would think. It's just tough.
Swinging is really good for their brains, and reading to them. Read to your children, read to your children. Oops, it's 12. Read to your children. That partly is my homeschooling coming through, but read to your children. That was one thing I started doing so that she could sit in church. We had story time all the time. The writing 8 exercise comes from Diane Kraft. I don't know if anyone has her book. And that's also the figure 8. You can buy an art tablet that's like 18 by 12. Take a small dinner plate and draw 2 circles on it, kind of like these circles would be here, and a line down the middle. And you'll use that to write each letter. You're going to trace it around like a train track with a fat crayon. Trace it around 2 times, write a letter. Trace it around 2 times, write the next letter. It's supposed to take 15 minutes. We were doing good if we could drag it out 7 minutes because everything was whiz-bang done fast. The book list, I went to reading and reading and reading and reading, trying to figure her out. Not that lots seemed to help, but the brain exercises and music, reading. Is that the main ones? But take care of yourselves as a mom. That was one of the things I really wanted to focus on. Find beauty. Women are made for beauty and to enjoy beauty. Find beauty wherever you can. Whether it's making a meal that looks nice or just picking a simple flower. It might be planting some wildflowers so your child can pick flowers endlessly instead of just popping the heads. Instead of popping the heads off of each of the pretty flowers in your flower bed, just plant wildflowers.
Get yourself a therapy dog.
That's iffy. They might be mean to the dog. Children with RAD tend to be mean to animals, so that's an iffy one. For myself. Oh, you're talking about me? I got a dog. It was my therapy dog. And I will happily talk about my dog as much as I will my children. What was the last one? Oh, the last paper is because I like it. And I have no idea if Mother Teresa said that, but anyhow, internet stands still for anything. You will teach them to fly, but they will not fly your flight. You'll teach them to dream, but they'll not dream your dreams. You'll teach them to live, but they'll not live your life. Nevertheless, in every flight, in every life, in every dream, the print of the way you taught will always remain.